And here we are. We are live. Hi, Graham.
Hey, Dan.
Hey. So you run the YouTube channel Archaic Lens.
Yep.
And you just recently published a book. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
That's right. Yeah. Well, my name's Graham Langdon. I publish under the handle Archaic Lens. And for the last few years, I've been basically tracking down statues and figurines from around the world with their hands around their navel, similar to the Moai of Easter Island, Urfa Man, the T-Pillars of Göbekli Tepe, some statues in Sulawesi, Indonesia. And I've actually found hundreds of other statues around the world from almost every ancient culture and civilization that we probably know of.
Wow. Yeah. As I remember, you had me kind of edit or proofread your book before you published it. And it was very interesting to see just how many of these things you really painstakingly pulled them up out of little corners and stuff. It was really interesting. There's quite a few places I hadn't even heard of that. Here's a naval statue.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think it hints at a connection between these cultures and civilizations as well.
Yeah, it definitely. I mean, it's that would be the implication. You know, that's not doesn't necessarily mean that that's the case, but it's when you couple that with a lot of the other evidence, it does start to tick another box that way, right?
That's right. Well, one of the things that I found as I started researching it was that a lot of times these naval idols emerge in the archaeological record at the same time people of a local region start working with copper.
Mm-hmm. And that was an interesting correlation as well.
Yeah, so I have some screens I can share really quickly if you're interested.
If I can, that's not as easy.
The option to share screens on my end.
Do you have it on your end?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Go for it then, please.
Yeah. Okay. So I think people are already familiar with the Moai of Easter Island. You know, there's almost 1,000 Moai on Easter Island. And they all have their hands meeting around their navel. And people are probably familiar with Urfa Man from Göbekli Tepe as well. It's the oldest life-size statue of a human ever discovered. His hands are around his navel and many of the T-pillars as well. But what's interesting is that when we go into Serbia and Kosovo, we have the Vinča civilization. And this figurine is from the Vinča civilization or Vinča culture. And you'll notice there's a V-neck garment that it's wearing, or some people theorize it's a necklace. And this is from the first civilization to smelt copper that we know of. The earliest copper smelting comes from the Belovod site on the Rudnik Mountain in Serbia from this culture.
So the very first time we see copper smelting show up, we see this naval statue.
That's right. And people theorize that they will eventually find earlier copper smelting in Turkey, because there are copper beads and jewelry made from a heating process that have been found to date to 10,000 years ago. But they haven't actually found evidence of copper smelting in Turkey yet. But it's theorized that they will find it eventually.
Wow, that's interesting. And yeah, that's the kind of thing that makes this interesting. I mean, 12 to 10,000 years ago is a long time ago for them to be smelting copper.
Yeah, yeah, very, very early date. The next copper furnace that we find anywhere in the world is actually in Israel at a site called Beersheba. And from the same time period they start smelting copper in Beersheba, Israel, they also start making these figurines. And they don't make just one of them. There's several of them in the Israel Museum and other museums around the world, like the British Museum. They have these figurines from this culture and time period.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's another very similar one. The naval hand right there on the navel, and the skinny arms. It's another thing that seems to be fairly common with these, is the arms look almost emaciated on a lot of these statues.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And a lot of times they just form like a perfect L shape. Sometimes the hands and arms blend into each other and it's like a single ring that goes around. So there's a few variations on the motif, but it becomes pretty clear when you start looking for it. What's being expressed, or at least that the motif is sort of being replicated around the world.
Yeah. Yeah. It does seem to show up a lot when you showed me the book. It was even in pottery and stuff. I remember that was just all over the place.
Yeah. Yeah. It's quite fascinating. Now, getting back to the copper. So we talked about the copper smelting from the Vinci civilization and the copper smelting in Israel. The first civilization in Mexico to use copper was actually the Olmecs. And this is an Olmec artifact on display in the Mexico National Museum of Anthropology. And you can see it's displaying the same motif as well. And again, we have the first culture to work with copper in Mexico, and then also the emergence of this artistic or symbolic motif.
Very interesting. Yeah, that is very interesting.
And I'll just keep going through the copper, if that's all right.
Absolutely. Run with it.
So we talked about Mexico. Now, the earliest use of copper in Portugal, one of them comes from the site of the Perdigos site in Portugal, and they found these figurines associated with the earliest use of copper in Portugal.
Well, that one's that's the ones that get the Ancient Aliens guys going on that guy. Look at that.
Yeah, some of these, I mean, yeah, the faces can look quite strange. I agree.
But yeah, there it is again, the same L-shaped arms, very emaciated look.
That's right.
That part it's really interesting. It's not just arms grasping the navel, although that's probably the most immediately obvious aspect of it. But the arms are almost always, and the fingers even are quite frequently elongated. It almost looks just like the arms are unnatural almost.
Yeah. Yeah. The arms do look strange in a lot of them. Okay. Now, first civilization or dynasty in China to work with copper was the Shang Dynasty. And this comes from the Shang Dynasty. This is a jade figurine from the first dynasty where we find copper artifacts in China.
Wow. There he is grasping his navel. His arms admittedly aren't very skinny, but it's the same L shape. He's holding his navel and it pops up at the same time as copper smelting does. Well, that's an interesting, very interesting correlation. Almost like it came with the toolkit of how to smelt metal.
That's exactly what I theorize is happening here, is that, you know, agricultural practices were spreading around the globe at around this time, and also domesticated varieties of crops like barley were spreading around the world at this time, too. And there's a chart that I really love to look at here. So this is the expansion of farming. And you can see it kind of starts in the Göbekli Tepe region of south central Anatolia there. And this is a map of the spread of agriculture through Europe. And so you can see the time periods that agricultural practices begin in different regions of Europe and the way that it spread and the trajectories that it took. And, you know, this may as well be a map of the spread of the naval idols as well, because they tend to emerge in line with the time periods you see here, in line with the spread of farming. And so, you know, I theorize that agricultural practices and domesticated varieties were spreading along with a cultural practice or a cultural package that included symbolism like the naval idols, included skills like copper working. And so these things were all kind of spreading together as a package. And there's one more chart that I like to look at, which is the spread of domesticated barley. Let's see here. So this maps the spread of barley. Again, it's spreading from Anatolia and it heads east. This is just the eastward expansion of domesticated barley. And you can see it goes down into India and across Mongolia to China and down through Malaysia. But we find naval idols along these routes as well. We find them in India, we find them in China, we find them in Iran and Iraq and a lot of these places. So I suspect these were all sort of spreading together in many instances.
Yeah, that's a interesting hypothesis. Is when that kind of symbolism that's, it's so... It's so uncanny the way that so many of them look the same, and then it popping up with agriculture and copper. That's a couple more checks there where it does kind of seem like a shared cultural practice.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's not going to be, I think, in every case. Sure. A lot of places don't have copper, right?
Yep. So
when you start getting into Polynesia, and we do find the naval idols all over Polynesia as well. I think a lot of these islands didn't actually have copper, so we don't see the copper working that we would expect to see. This symbolism emerges. Yeah, it's fascinating nonetheless.
Yeah. There's that Starlink you were talking about. Elon, fix the internet. Yeah, just for my audience really quick. I did upgrade. I hooked an Ethernet cable up and stuff to my MacBook, and I bought a webcam, but I haven't had a chance to hook it up. I'm trying to make it look better. Hopefully it looks a little better this time. Sorry that it's been like falling off. I'm not sure what the deal is lately. It sucks. But I'm working on it, damn it. All right, anyway, sorry. Cherry on. I've had a few complaints about that, and I appreciate people showing up to watch live, and I don't want them to feel like I'm just going to leave them in, you know, 280p land. So,
yeah.
Thanks, Raymond. All right, I'll go ahead and carry on, Graham. Sorry to sidetrack there.
Okay, well, yeah, I'll just cycle through some more photos I've got.
Absolutely.
This is from France, and this is associated with the earliest copper working in France, and this is a culture, and I'm probably going to butcher the name, called the Groupe de Trois, or Tri, but but they actually settled along copper veins and began working copper. And these are called the statue miners, and they're all on display in a museum in Aveyron, France. And again, they were associated with the earliest copper working in France.
Nice. Very interesting. And this one has those elongated fingers. Its arms are, it's hard to tell for sure, but those arms look like an L-shaped, but those fingers are definitely elongated like that.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, it's really interesting. Those little aspects of it is kind of the, you know, the part that makes it. It's a bunch of guys holding their stomachs is interesting, but when the arms start being positioned very similarly more often than not, or their shape's the same more often than not, and these are kind of unique at that point, it does, in my opinion, it, you know, Occam's razor would, you know, suggest that it, one came from the other.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I'm not claiming that these are all definitely connected, but it sure kind of seems like it might be. I'm certainly open to the possibility, but I'm also open to the possibility that I could be wrong and this is all just a bunch of coincidences.
But it would be an awful lot of them when it starts getting that far around the world and it comes with the other aspects of it. The copper smelting in particular, you know, farming is something that you could argue is a little less elaborate or a little less unique to pop up. But the smelting of metal is something that's a little bit, it doesn't just crop up all over the place. It kind of pops up in little areas here and there at different times throughout history. So seeing the same iconography show up, it actually makes a lot of sense. There was a very strong tradition in the Middle Ages and stuff between tradespeople to guard their trades. It's kind of the beginning of your trade unions and your secret societies and stuff. A lot of this was just specifically to hide the knowledge of your trade.
Oh, and
it wouldn't be surprising at all if this was some like ancient version of it. This was the iconography that was associated with the guys that knew how to make copper. That's, I mean, speculative, but it's point is there's not without historical precedent.
Yeah. I think that might be what we're seeing here. This is an article. And on that point, I just want to show you this. This is an article from the Jerusalem Post. It's dated October 4th, 2020. So it's about 4 years old, and it's about the discovery of the copper furnace in Beersheba. And it actually states, and this study was conducted by these high-ranking people at the Department of Archaeology and Ancient Near Eastern Civilization at Tel Aviv University in association with all these other people from the Israel Antiquities Authority and the Geological Survey of Israel. And what it says here is that, I'm just going to read this quote from the article that I'm highlighting here. This study sheds light both on the level of technical advancement in that era and region and the hierarchy in the society, giving evidence for a theory that there was a clearly defined elite that possessed expertise and knew professional secrets, which preserved its power because its members were the only ones who knew how to create shiny copper. So they're theorizing here that there was basically this elite group that knew the secrets of copper working. preserving its power because they were the only ones who knew the secret of copper working. And so if that is the case, and that is kind of like my whole theory, but I think it expands far beyond Israel. I think that there's a connection kind of amongst all of these cultures, and they were sort of spreading around the world over the course of what seems to be 10,000 years, which is astonishing if true.
Yeah, it is. Almost at that point, the way it shows up in so many varying times.
Yeah.
It's the kind, that's the, one of the first things that a skeptical person would point at, but it's also the kind of thing that, I mean, you can look at human history now and there are some religious symbols that do just keep going, or some worker symbols that just keep going, or some words like that. I mean, we still say that a person's not worth his salt if he's no good at work. And that's because the Romans paid their laborers in salt.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's the root of the word salary.
Oh,
that is salt. Yeah. It wouldn't be surprising at all. You know, the square and the plumb bob that are in the Freemason symbols, those are not, that wasn't put there in the 1800s. You know, these things have been around for a very long time. So yeah. It wouldn't be surprising if this grasp navel symbolizing the smelting of copper, it wouldn't be surprising at all if that outlived all religions and all other things that were attached to that cult or whatever, that aspect of that culture. Cause that's the kind of thing that, to use like the Richard Dawkins meme analogy, are you aware of the way when he first used the word meme, it wasn't like an internet meme. It was an idea that competed like a gene. So like ideas like happy birthday, you know, or people have been singing it for thousands of years or whatever. It just gets passed on and passed on. Ideas that aren't as enticing or as effective, they die off. So right. this meme of copper smelting with this symbolism was what is obviously effective. If what your hypothesis was true, obviously that would be an effective when you're smelting copper, right? So the symbolism that came with that, with these advanced tools. I'm being told that memes weren't Dawkins' invention, but that's not, well, I that's not what the internet says. But anyway.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, imagine life in the Neolithic. People have never known metal. People have never seen metal. They've never worked with metal. All they've had are stone tools for the entire history of hominid evolution and existence. And all of a sudden, there's this group of people that has this shiny new substance with special properties. It's malleable. You can beat it. You can heat it. You can mix it with things. You can shape it. You can pour it into molds. You can do all these things with copper that people have never seen before. I mean, that probably would have sort of given these people a lot of power and influence in their day as the Neolithic was transitioning to the Chalcolithic.
So oh, absolutely. There's so many tools that, I mean, think about the amount of labor that would go into just making a stone bowl compared to once you know how to work copper, how fast you could make a family's worth of stone bowls and cups.
Right.
And
which you can make these artifacts. You're right. You're absolutely right.
So this would become like way more than just weaponry and stuff, just for everyday life. These would, and then they would look cool and become status symbols. That aspect of humanity always tickles me. Anytime anything becomes a status symbol, you will see rich people just grabbing it. And there's a situation once where a train was stuck in the mountains and it was snowed in, and milk on the train started, the price of milk started to spike. This is like 100 years ago. And the price of milk started to spike on the train. The rich people quit buying liquor and started buying milk because it was a status symbol to buy milk. not all rich people are that way, but it's the people that like to flaunt it, you know, the Daugherty's of the world. So yeah, it would have ran with from the poorest person to the richest, is my point. This would have been something that would have been awesome.
You're absolutely right. The shiny, it was the original shiny new thing.
Yes, there you go.
The lengths people go through today to get the latest shiny new thing, whether it's a car or a house or a boat or whatever. You know, this was the original version of that as we were coming out of the Stone Age.
Yeah, that's wild.
Yeah,
that is wild. I mean, it's gold. They were messing with gold, from what I understand, first. This is one of the first metals that was worked, but there's not a whole lot you can do with gold besides look at it. until you've messed with electricity, which is another thing altogether. Hello to everybody in the chat. I try, it's a lot harder to respond to you guys now than it is on a live streams are a lot harder than a premiere where I'm just watching a video I already made. So I'm trying to talk to Graham here. So it's hard to say hi to all you guys over and over, but hello and thank you for being here. All right. You still there?
Yep.
I'm okay here. All right. Looked like you froze for a second there.
I'm searching for this gold artifact that I found in a museum in Bulgaria. It dates to the earliest use of gold, because we were just talking about gold. And it too, it's, I found it. Okay, let me bring this up on my screen. Give me one.
Absolutely.
Second here. Gold. If I can. Had all my slides prepared, but I didn't.
Oh, you're all good. Oh, shit. There he went. Oh, he'll be back in a second, I'm sure. Well, all right. I'll talk to you guys here for a second. Raymond, I'm going to worry about you guys. I mean, shit, you're here watching. Thanks, Going South. Hey, Nuts and Bolts. What about native copper? If you're talking about, like, unworked copper or, like, unsmelted copper, like where they just find it in the natural state, that was used for a lot longer, but it's not... it's not nearly as good as the smelted stuff for working with things. You're kind of stuck to a degree from what I understand. Copper is found in a very pure form. Yep, here he's back. All right.
This gold idol, yep. And it just X'd out my screen for some reason. Sorry about
that. Right. You're all right. You're back now. Somebody says Graham didn't have enough copper in his internet cable. So.
There is. Okay, well, I'm not going to attempt. There is a gold artifact in my book. I'll give the plug for the book now.
Sure, yeah.
Mystery of the Naval Idols, and it'll be a lot easier to just show you from here.
It's a great book, by the way. There's a lot of really interesting photos in it, yeah.
This comes from the earliest use of gold in human civilization. It's from Bulgaria. It's a little bit different. The arms are a little bit more bowed, but I suspect it might be a similar motif being expressed here. So,
yeah, it's definitely interesting. Definitely interesting idea to think that might have just been part of metalworking in the early days. The guy holding his tummy. Right. Could have even been just thinking of it now, even, which is funny because I read your book, but. Just thinking of it now, maybe that's a symbol for bellows of some sort of pushing of air onto a fire.
Could be. Yeah, I tend to think of it as probably like a symbol of fertility. I think a lot of these artifacts are labeled as fertility idols in the museum. Mm. And I think we're dealing with a group of people that were ancient farmers, of course. So fertility of the field was important to them. Fertility of their people was important to them. They were trying to increase their numbers and increase their population because, of course, human population was a lot less in these times. And then I also think, you know, this naval symbolism, we all come from a navel. It represents birth and creation. So it's like almost like the original symbol of creation itself, perhaps. So that's what I think some of the symbolism might be getting at. But then I think it's also kind of like, you know, if society and civilization collapsed and thousands of years from now, archaeologists were digging through the rubble of our collapsed civilization, and maybe they find a figurine of like Jesus on the cross, and they find that in Mexico, and they find that in the United States, and they find it in Australia and Japan and China and wherever, you know, they might theorize that some ancient religion had made its way around the world, spreading its symbolism. And, you know, to me, that's kind of the closest analog in my mind, but they might perhaps label that as a deity of some ancient religion. And that would only scratch the surface of the entire like hierarchy and pyramid of, say, the Catholic Church and Christianity and all the layers of infrastructure and the missions over thousands of years to spread the religion around the world. So we do have a contemporary analog for what I'm proposing in this book.
Yeah, that's very true. That's, you would see the same symbolism, like I was saying earlier with the Freemason stuff, but the like Christianity, the Christian cross is a very great example of that. It's ubiquitous. If you go around the world, you're going to find it almost everywhere.
Yeah. And I'm sure people would debate whether or not they were connected
at all. You know, you're a thousand years apart. Make
figurines like this. Yep. People do.
And it'd be a thousand, you know, like a thousand years apart as well. I mean, you got crusaders rocking it and little old lady today at church. And so, all over the place. Yeah. And then there'd be people that say, well, you know, if you're laying two planks on the ground, if you're going to nail them together, a cross is the most simplest form to make, and they'll just dismiss it out of hand. So you're gonna get all kinds, and I don't really begrudge for the most part, even those guys that are skeptical that way, I don't really begrudge that, as long as they're not assholes about it and completely cynical. If they got an open mind, I don't mind them saying, you know, I don't think so, Tim. That's just fine. It actually helps us get to where we're going, if you ask me. To quote AJ from the Y Files, if we prove 95% of these things are fake, doesn't that make that other 5% that much cooler?
Yeah.
I
think people generally have like way too much ego wrapped up in their theories. It's like if you attack someone's theory, you're attacking them personally. Like, I don't care if my theory is right or wrong. I feel like this is something interesting I want people to look at. Decide for yourself if you think there's a connection or not. I certainly find it intriguing. But if you want to tear down my whole argument and thesis, then go for it. That has nothing to do with me personally.
Yeah, that's a good attitude to take. It's a hard one to take. I've posited before that it's my guess that that's one of the reasons that archaeology tends to be more vitriolic when it comes to challenging their stuff, is that a lot of times that's, you know, the hard science side of it, you run your data on this and the carbon dating is this, the chemical makeup is that. There's not much room for interpretation. But when you start talking about what does this mean? Well, does the hands on the stomach mean bellows, or does it mean fertility? Well, let's argue about it until one of us is proven right and the other one goes home with their tail between their legs. That seems to be the way they go about it. So it's not completely, maybe in their hallowed halls of academia, they probably are much nicer to each other. But if you don't have the proper credentials, you don't get to have that discussion.
Yeah, I mean, it is this really interesting confluence of the rivers of subjectivity and objectivity. Because on one hand, you have the objectivity of the carbon dates and the layers of strata. And then you have the subjectivity of interpreting it all. And, you know, that interpretation aspect of it, as much as people want to say it's science, it really isn't. It's just kind of, it's more of a creative process of imagining what these things could mean, what the symbolism could mean, how these things are connected or not connected at all. But there is like this layer of science underneath it where you're getting carbon dates and you're dating seeds and you're dating charcoal remains and all that. And so I think they do give us a pretty good idea of like the time periods of things. And I'm not really contesting any of the chronologies of any of the cultures that I look at in the book. I think everything actually fits really neatly together because you can see how the symbolism spreads over thousands of years. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, no, that was one of the things I noticed about your book, was it didn't really rely on challenging the only challenge that it really would have to the mainstream narrative would be that these cultures were in contact. It crossed from the old world to the new world in particular. That would be where you would find some pushback. But beyond that, that's, you know, everything you're saying is just an explanation for why we see this symbolism, making an observation and then making a hypothesis, one that we can't really test, but it's in the world of archaeology. So like we were just discussing, once you get into that part of it, you're not really in the realm of science anymore. You're in the realm of Graham Hancock, which is why they hate him so much. Probably you just get to write up your own story.
Yeah, he gets to do all the fun stuff.
Oh yeah. Yeah, get to meet him here in a couple of days. It's going to be great. Oh, yeah, somebody asked in the chat earlier if I was ever going to interview Graham. Yeah, in a couple of days, I'm going to be interviewing him, and then I'll have to edit and stuff. And Ed Bernhardt, I am in contact with a friend who knows him. So maybe we'll see. We'll see how, if he's willing to talk to an evil person like me or not. But if you know who Ed Barnhart is, the archaeologist, he's on Ancient Aliens sometimes. He's on He was recently interviewed. God, who was it that he was on? Damn it. I can't remember. Lex Fridman, I think. And he was, he's one of the good ones. He's one of the ones that he was on Ancient Apocalypse season two. He's willing to talk about these things with and say openly, I disagree, I disagree, I disagree, but he's not going to be an ass about it. So I'm hoping to get him on as well.
Cool. Yeah, that's an exciting lineup.
Yeah, Graham's, it's going to be great to talk to Graham, but yeah, we got you on today, and I'm going to be talking to Graham a little bit about some of the navel grasping stuff for sure, because it is something that me and him, when we talked a little bit before, we've discussed that a tiny bit, not a whole lot, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it came up on the second episode of Ancient Apocalypse, and I think a lot of people have noticed, right, that the hand position of the Moai is similar to the hand position of Urfaman and a lot of the T-pillars of Göbekli Tepe, and similar to the statues of Sulawesi, Indonesia. But I don't think most people realize how deep it goes. And again, in my book, The Mystery of the Naval Idols, I literally have hundreds of photographs of naval idols from all over the world with this hand position, from almost every great ancient culture that has ever existed. I mean, it's just crazy how many of these things there are out there.
That was one of the things that blew my mind, was it was like everywhere. It was all over the place. Go ahead. Let me set you up to show your screen alone here. It's a button that I press here. Sorry.
This is a ceremonial Tumi knife from the Lambayeque civilization of Peru. And they would use this to slit the throats of sacrificial victims.
And there he is with his navel grasping hands.
Yeah. So that's just another intriguing example, of which there are so many. This is the sort of like canonical Inca idol on the... So this here, the Inca made so many idols that look just like this. And the hands rest a little bit higher. Maybe they're slightly above the belly or around where the belly is. But this was far and away the canonical Inca idol that they made so many of.
Interesting. Yeah, that's definitely very, very similar. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Rue. I appreciate the ticket fee, as you always call them. I'll go ahead and keep you on the solo layout for a second so they can still hear me, but they can see you.
Cool. Yeah, I was recently in Micronesia touring Nan Madol and found this statue in someone's front yard.
Yeah, that's just wild. Just in their front yard. Just, where's it from? I don't know. It was around here. We just grabbed it, stuck it out front.
I tracked down the person who carved it at the workshop where they carved him, and I asked them about the statue, and they told me that these statues come from Nuku Oro, which is a very difficult island to reach in Micronesia. The only way you can get there is aboard a cargo boat. And it's a 500-mile journey from Pohnpei. And then the boat drops you off, and then you have to wait there until the cargo boat comes back, and then you can hop on it and get back to Pohnpei. But they say they've been carving these statues in Micronesia on Nuku Oro for as long as anyone can imagine or remember. The name of the statue is the Tino Aitu, and they call it the Navigator. And they basically say that these statues commemorate somebody. And I got this interview on film with the indigenous locals of Pohnpei explaining this to me, that I'll hopefully get up on my channel soon, that a navigator came to their island of Nuku Oro, taught them skills, and then left. And then when he left, they started carving these statues in his honor. And that's their story of why they started carving these statues.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah,
I remember when I was reading the book, you talked the part where you talked about not being able to get to that island, and that's always that stuff is always so just, that's a tantalizing part right there when you're like, you're go as I'm reading the book, and it's like there's so much just interesting stuff, and then it's like, and there's the fog, there's where you just like you can't quite put your hand such an interesting part of the book. It's a great book to begin with, but that part right there was where it was just like, oh come on, damn it. It's like the cliffhanger, but it's not your fault. It's the way that, and that's what's beautiful. It's what most of us love about this stuff is the mystery.
Yeah, there's definitely hard to reach places out there that might shed some light on some of these mysteries.
Well, it would make sense that that would be the case. I mean, it, just here locally, it's well off topic, but the looking for places that are hard to reach here in the Channeled Scabland, or here in Washington, we have the Channeled Scablands where Randall Carlson likes to take people on tours and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And there's a dozen or so places where there's big mesas that are, they're just islands that the flood just went around. They're the same height as the surrounding terrain. They're old. They're almost completely inaccessible. There's nobody living up there. There's no road that goes up. There's no trail that goes up the side of most of these. It's, you'd almost have to take a helicopter or be a rock climber to get up them.
Did you tour the Channel Scablands with Randall Carlson recently?
I didn't. I talked to the guys at the beginning of their tour, and me and my son went through there on a road trip across the state, and we stopped at like about a half a dozen spots.
His theory is that it's a remnant of a mega flood. Is that correct?
Yes, his theory is that it's a remnant of a mega flood. The mainstream theory is that it's the remnants of numerous floods. But even that one does posit that the one of the last ones was a lot bigger than the rest. I'm not 100% on it either way. It's really interesting, but that's why I want to get to the top of those mesas, is because they still have topsoil on most of them, the old topsoil, like they do on the rest of the terrain, but they're almost completely inaccessible. So if there's any, you know, if there's any semblance or any remnants of what was there from before the flood, it, all in that region, those mesas would be the best bet, just because less likely to have been picked clean over the years. So I really want to go up there, and that's where, but it, I probably go to Rested just climbing the damn thing, unless I get a bunch of permits and all that crap. But I'm talking to, I even talked to a helicopter pilot about it a little bit. And he's like, yeah, you're going to need the state to sign off on me setting my ass down up there, buddy. Like,
darn. Really? Even just to fly over it, or to set down there?
To set down there.
Oh, okay.
But I'm a little old to be rappelling out the side like a freaking airborne ranger. So I'd rather climb it than do that, to be honest, or get a drone and just fly it across the top. One of them LiDAR drones. There you go.
Yeah, the LiDAR drones.
Yeah. But yeah, that's a little outside my pay grade. But anyway, not to derail you, my point is that the places that are inaccessible, the places that we haven't really done the digging and looking yet, those are the ones where, you know, I think all of us would really love to go first. So like that island that you were talking about here, if that was to become mainstream part of the alternate history narrative in 2 years, that would be one of the places people went and stopped. You wouldn't have to wait for a cargo boat anymore. It'd be damn near an Uber going out there.
Right. And I'm sure an unfortunate consequence of that would probably be that ancient culture would start to slip away to resorts and airlines, McDonald's and Starbucks.
Oh yeah, even the stuff that was ancient would become a semblance of itself. The statues would become whatever the tourists want to see. Look at Kachina. You can see this very clearly in the Kachina dolls of the Southwest Native Americans. I don't know if you're familiar with those.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Yeah. The old ones look like indigenous American art. The new ones look like mass-produced freaking statues that are made to look like Native American art, right? They're made
like the gas stations and the rest stops.
You'll find the cheap versions of them, but the good ones now are made by like the artisans used to make them for ceremonial purposes, and they were made like out of corn cobs, and they weren't they didn't look great. They looked like something that, like a fetish. Mm-hmm. But the ones now look like they're fully sculpted, posed statues. There's just statues of Native American spirits that you would not look out of place in a museum, right? And an art museum, not an old history museum. So it's my point is that their culture, tourism, even perverted it. So even though they had this old art form, was still preserved. Over time, tourism unpreserved that for them just naturally. So yeah, if we started going to that island, they'd be making those statues differently in 20 years' time. Have a little Doritos logo on it or some shit.
Yeah. Good to leave some places untouched by capitalism in the modern world, I suppose.
Yeah, sad as it is, I mean, it's little places like that. Tiny little areas, they tend to have systems that would never seem to work in the larger world. And you don't really want to, you almost don't want to go mess with it, right?
Right, like the uncontacted tribes of the Amazon. It's like, we're going to need them to survive and repopulate the planet when our civilization collapses.
Exactly. If Graham Hancock's right, we're going to have to have somebody to go hide out amongst to catch food for us while we teach them to farm. But yeah, it's pretty wild when you think about the different touches between cultures that have happened over the years that are undocumented and that leave just that little wisp, that little, you can't quite, like in the new ancient apocalypse, where they talk about the walls on Rapa Nui and Easter Island, and in Sacsayhuaman, the similarity of some of the stonework and stuff. It's just, it's not quite enough to say for certain the two are connected, but then you start getting other things and the DNA and whatnot and the plant evidence. And it becomes all of a sudden this really tantalizing time in human history that there's just nothing known about.
Yeah. And,
you yeah, wonder
if certainly gets overturned seemingly overnight, where there's like, oh, South Americans never could have made it to Easter Island. And now there's all this evidence from DNA that they have. And then the wall makes sense. That wall at the Ahu Vinipu certainly seems like a calling card from South American Masons.
Yeah, it certainly does. And the thing is, to me, and it's insane, the idea, you know, that the people reached Easter Island and their story says that they came there and then went and then came back, like they were intending to settle the place. So they found it. They could navigate to it. The idea that people couldn't find South America from there is just insane. How the fuck? Well, how do you even get there? Are these guys, they unless the idea is they got blown off course and happened to hit Easter Island, in which case, you know, the odds against that, that's almost astronomical. The odds against that are just way up there. And we know now, at least the archaeology says that from the lowest humanly habitated layers show evidence of foods from both Asia and South America. So
that's right. And they find evidence of bananas from 3,000 years ago, and it kind of pushed the populating of Easter Island back by a few thousand years. And then you've got the transoceanic currents. Right. All you have to do from South America is basically put your boat on the coast and it will just the ocean current will take you straight to Polynesia. So really all they would have to do, all someone would have had to do, is just kind of build a raft and hang on for long enough and they'd make it there. And Thor Heyerdahl actually did just that in his book Kon-Tiki, which is a great book. I would recommend everyone to read. It's an incredible adventure where he basically tries to prove people from South America could have gotten to Polynesia by building a balsa wood raft out of materials from the South American jungle and then just floating on the raft with his crew straight to Polynesia.
Yeah, that's he was pretty amazing with a lot of the stuff that he dug into. He got a lot of crap for his rafting. A lot of people gave him a lot of shit for it back in the day. If you read contemporary articles, there's a lot of disdain for him. But there's a lot of people
end with anything revolutionary.
Yes, that's exactly it.
Anytime you're trying to overturn the paradigm, there's going to be all sorts of people attacking you, telling you you're crazy, calling you an idiot, everything.
Yeah, which is sad. But he's definitely an interesting individual. It's fun watching Graham talk about knowing him, because by the time I was into this stuff, Thor Heyerdahl he hadn't passed, but he was, you know, he wasn't talking to people.
Yeah.
But at least not me, nobody at my pay grade anyway. Yeah. But he definitely, he was the first one to posit the connection between South America and Easter Island, as far as from the masonry, as far that I'm aware of anyway.
Yeah, that's in line with my understanding as well.
Right on. But yeah, so your book is available on Amazon, right? You've got it up on Amazon now?
That's right. You can search for The Mystery of the Naval Idols on Amazon. And shipping in the U.S. Hopefully I'm going to get it a digital version that will be instantly downloadable worldwide within the next week or so. But right now it's only available on Amazon in the U.S.
Right on. I will make sure and put a link to it below when we're done here. I didn't put a link to that, but I got a link to your YouTube and your Twitter so that they should be able to find you as needed. But that the book, honestly, I would seriously recommend it, guys. There's no better catalog of these things than in that book. And like just to give it a touchstone of how hard this kind of stuff can be. When I did my research for the megalithic metal clamp video, so I'm looking at metal clamps in Egypt and in China and in Korea and in South America. And one thing that I found that was extremely frustrating was there's very little cataloged. Oh, yes, there's metal clamps at Edfu. Well, how many of them are still stone or wood clamps or metal? How many are in place? How many are just negative spaces? There were metal clamps at Edfu. that's where the evidence ends. And there's not even a catalog. You can't just go like Google and say megalithic metal clamps in the ancient world and get any sort of a list. And it's the same thing with these naval statues. But your book has them like a huge number of them, probably 100, I would guess, something like that, cataloged.
Almost 200.
But there you go. Twice the amount that I was saying there. And cataloged and told where they come from and stuff. So if somebody's doing this research, it's pretty much invaluable. I couldn't imagine. I mean, I'm not just trying to toot your horn here. I'm dead serious. If you were looking into this, I can't imagine a better resource.
Thank you for saying that. Yeah, I think it's like not only the authoritative source on naval idols, but also perhaps the only source that's comprehensive on this intriguing phenomenon. I'd like to share something else. We were talking about Easter Island, and of course, amongst the natives of Easter Island, their own traditions state that they came from their homeland of Hiva. And in the Marquesas Islands, there's two islands named Hiva. There's Hiva O and Nuku Hiva. And so I was curious about the art of the Marquesas Islands. And sure enough, many, many statues in the Marquesas have their hands around their navel as well. And here's just one example. This statue is made out of wood and it's on display in the Museum of Tahiti. And you can see their hands are pretty much in the same position as the Moai of Easter Island. And that's just one, but I'll share a few more examples from the Marquesas Islands because they're just so fascinating. And this is actually, these are examples of what they would call Tiki, which was one of their chief deities. And the Tiki in the Marquesas Islands is always depicted with its hands around its navel. And so I think that actually lends a lot of credibility to the idea that perhaps some group of people settling Easter Island at some point in time did come from the Marquesas Islands. At least there seems to be a symbolic and cultural thread between them. I'll show some more from the Marquesas because I love these. These ones are all made out of wood from the Marquesas. And again, these are all tiki statues, what you would call tiki. And then, you know, interesting side note, the term tiki got sort of co-opted by Western capitalism. And now people only know it as like a tiki bar or a tiki theme this or tiki theme that. That was literally the name of their chief deity. And it became bastardized and capitalized upon. And the people of Polynesia really, really don't like that we have places called tiki bars and tiki torches and all this commercialized merchandise under the name of their god. And, you know, they would like us to stop doing that. But the tiki statues from the Marquesas are fascinating. They all have their hands around their navel, just like the Moai of Easter Island.
Wow, that is interesting. Yeah, at the end of World War II, the Southwest Islands, East Asian islands, Polynesian land, what do they call it? Oceania. That was very, very popular in American culture. It had been in the news all the time, and we'd seen all these wars, all these battles, but we'd also seen all the beautiful scenery and stuff. And it was it was all the rage there in the 50s and 60s. As you can see, if you look at the pop culture of the time. So it's not surprising that we co-opted that and just slapped a freaking brand on it.
Yeah. Yeah, this is
more tikis here?
Yeah, we have this is another tiki statue from the Marquesas Islands. And this one, you can see the navel quite clearly and the hands kind of meeting around the navel.
I mean, there's another one of those alien-looking bastards here, too.
Yeah, yeah, they look very strange.
Yeah, these ones look like something you'd see out of a Lovecraft novel, so those half-fish, half-people things. Yeah.
Right up there with Cthulhu.
Let me grab a link to your book real quick. People are telling me to spam it in the chat, and I am going to do just that. So okay. Let me just jump my happy ass over to Amazon, and I'll search up your book here. Well, but you go ahead and...
I'll just keep yapping.
Yeah, go ahead. Keep on yapping, and don't give that statue a dollar. He said he'll know about the statue. What's the exact name of your book again?
The Mystery of the Naval Idols.
The Mystery of the Naval Idols. There, this... Hopefully, honestly, this, I might be kind of kicking myself in the butt here and opening a can of worms that I'll regret, but the honest to God truth is I get asked all the time, since people know that I communicate with Graham Hancock, I get asked frequently to hey, send Graham this, send Graham that, tell Graham this, tell Graham that. Oh shit, man, it took up two posts to even get that thing. God dang it. Is there a way to get a different link that's not like all massive like this?
You can, if you click share on the Amazon page, okay, it'll give you a shortened link.
All right, sorry, I'm on my computer and all the share button, something I'm only aware of on my phone. I'm a little old. Sorry. All right, thank you. Sorry about that.
Let's see.
The first one works, somebody says. All right, cool. Sorry about that. I'm trying, guys. We'll let Graham help us out here. But yeah, what I was ever since people found out that I'm in communication with Graham Hancock, a couple of people are saying the link is working. So click that top one, guys, if you're not able to. But a lot of people are asking me to tell them, to tell Graham all kinds of stuff. I get all the time, hey, would you let Graham know X, Y, or Z? I think this, and I want you, and I understand. At the same time, it's like, you know, if I was to have 1% of my followers tell me what a question they wanted to ask Graham, I would have 400 different things to ask Graham when I see him, right? But so I tend to just, you know, I'm sorry, guys, I'm just going to talk to you about the things I'm interested in. But I do have to say that this book is one of the things I'm going to mention to him, is to tell him that this is cool. Because it's a resource. It's the kind of thing for him. It will save him a ton of time. That's exactly what I'm telling him. So next time you're researching this stuff, you should probably use this book. You have $40 and grab it while you're here in the States, Graham, because they won't ship it to you in the UK. You'll have to send it to me and they'll have to send it to you. But anyway. Well, you get what I'm saying. Yeah, no, no. I hope I'm not opening too big of a can of worms here and getting a whole bunch more spam. And I hope I'm not pissing people off that I just kind of ignore when they say, hey, could you tell Graham? Because it's just not realistic, guys. I can't. Now I'm having people saying it doesn't work. So yeah, if you have a way to get that link, my phone's damn it. I'll put a link in here somewhere somehow, but
Here, you know what? Let me send it to you on Twitter. I'm having a problem connecting to the chat, but
okay.
I'll send it to you on Twitter, and then you could grab it from perfect there.
All right, and there we go. Hopefully this is a shorter link.
I think so.
Let's find out. Let's find out. It looks kind of long. Is it one or two? Come on. Hey, it came up as only one post. So hopefully they can use that. If you read Graham's book, remember to leave a review. It only has 4 so far. Yes, thank you, Nuts and Bolts. Make sure that... Graham, is that your Amazon shop?
Yeah, I mean, there's only one book on there, but that's my Amazon shop, yep.
All right. That worked. Where I'm being told, good job. Okay, awesome. So it looks like they are able to get into there, and I'll use that link. And multiple people now saying the link works. Awesome, guys. Seriously, I don't get a red cent from this or anything. I said I did do the I proofread the book, but I'm not doing this because Graham's sending me money or anything like that. This is straight up. If you're interested in this, you're not going to find a better resource. So see, you'll spend 2 years on Google, literally 2 years on Google, and still not find all the shit that it's from his book unless somebody steals it from his book and puts it on the internet. He traveled there himself. So
I'm sure it will happen soon. Yeah, I took all the photographs in the book myself. I traveled to over 20 countries. I haven't tallied up the full number because I'm still finding them. There's still ones on my list that I need to go to. There's still countries where I know they exist that I haven't been to yet. So there might be another edition of the book that comes out one day, but I think the book in its current form at least sort of provides a good foundation for really understanding what is a global ancient phenomenon. And yeah. I don't think people realize how deep it really goes.
Yeah, that's I would agree. And even if people like their root hypothesis is 180 degrees off from yours, if this is something they're interested in researching, they're still not going to find a better catalog of this. Somebody said, so the book is full of typos. No, now that I proofread it, there's not a bunch of typos there. It just says fuck about every 14th word. That's what's different. That's the only thing that's different. His fucking statue with the fucking hands on it. Well, thank you, Joe. I've worked on this beard for months now. but I was really... look, before we go here, another like 20, 30 minutes... you've been to the reshot before too, as well.
I've been to the reshot structure twice,
and I don't think you found any naval statues there. But what did you find?
Well, on my most recent expedition to the reshot structure, I did actually find thousands upon thousands of stone tools.
Oh wow!
Yeah, I found thousands of stone tools. It's on my most recent video on my YouTube channel. Basically, I was looking for salt and seashells. The reshot structure is so vast and so massive and so desolate that when you get there, if you're interested in exploring the possibility that it is Atlantis, and, you know, on the topic, I realize Atlantis is such a contested and touchy word these days, but I find it funny that people say that searching for Atlantis is somehow supporting racism when the most popular theory for the location of Atlantis is in Africa right now. So anyway, I just thought that was an ironic little observation. I don't say one way or another whether or not I think the reshot structure is the location of Atlantis, but I think it's a fascinating place. And I've been there twice to investigate what is there. And, so I was looking for salt and seashells, and I befriended a nomad in the desert. And again, this is on my latest video on my YouTube channel. You can check it out if you're interested. And he wanted to show me a place where he thought the ocean used to be. Those were his words. And we went down into this valley, and there was salt down there. And then there were thousands of stone tools. They looked like Acheulean hand axes, Acheulean bifaces. It's the second tool, more or less, that hominids ever used. And again, I don't know if archaeologists even know about this site. I don't know if anyone knows about this site or knows that this is there other than this nomad in the desert. But I got a lot of footage of it, and then I left because it's a sensitive archaeological site. I didn't realize what I was going to be walking into when I encountered these tools down there. I was very careful not to step on any of them or disturb the site in any way. I took some photos, took some videos, and got out of there. But there's what I suspect to be some vast number, possibly tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands. There could be even a million. It's just an enormous area, and every other rock you look at is a hand axe. Absolutely. I've never seen anything like it. I think that, it looked like the remnants of an ancient city, but what doesn't make any sense to me is the fact that these Acheulean hand axes tend to date from anywhere from a million years old to 200 or 100,000 years old. So they're incredibly ancient. It's typically understood to be the second tool that hominids ever used, the first being the monoface and then the biface. Instead of carving just one side of the stone, they carved both sides. And it was used for chopping and splitting. It was like your original Swiss Army knife, basically. And there's just thousands upon thousands of them in a valley at the Reshot structure. So that was the big exciting thing that I found. I did find salt and seashells as well, but I was absolutely floored to discover thousands of stone tools there. And again, I got some footage, put it up on my YouTube. And yeah, I don't know. Was it a stone tool factory? Was it a city? How old are they? I have no idea. I don't have answers to any of these questions.
Remnants of an ancient archaeological cache. They like some ancient university, and they did all the archaeology for 5,000 years ago, put them there, and they got wiped out.
Yeah. Yeah. Something like that. Actually, but it doesn't look like you walk around in this valley and it's like, oh, this actually absolutely looks like it was a prehistoric city. The amount of human activity that's evidenced there is just beyond anything I had ever seen from that time period. So
that's wild. You'll have to check that out. I've been so busy lately. I feel bad because I've been having a hard time keeping up with my guests' latest content. And no offense to you. I mean, that's just busy lately. But that's really interesting. That area is so underexplored and so under excavated. I mean, despite the claims that there's thousands of sites over there and whatnot, I mean, it's hard to even travel there from what I understand. It's not like not super hard, but it's not like you could just get off a plane and just go walk off over there. You've got to make some arrangements, and it's not exactly the safest place in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a difficult place to penetrate, one might say. I can bring up a clip right now if you're interested.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's see here. I'll just show you some of these stone tools that were found. Okay, let's see. Let's see. Okay, places like this kind of gives you an idea.
Holy
right
shit.
Here. Yeah. massive piles of stone tools. And most of the rocks you see here, when you look closely at them, I mean, some of them were like very cleanly arranged, but this whole valley, just there's tons. And in some cases, you even find the chips of the tool that flaked off the tool next to the tool itself. Let me see if I can find a good example of that.
Which those are still considered artifacts, according to archaeology. That's a lithic specimen. Any chunk of stone worked by a human hand, even a tiny little chip, so small you can barely see it, it's still, if it was worked by a human hand, it's still considered an artifact.
Okay, this is one such example. I think what we're looking at here is two chips lying at the base of a tool. Maybe they fell off later. But yeah, just absolutely fascinating sight with just the entire valley is just littered with these stone tools. And I suspect there's somewhere in the thousands to possibly tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of these tools in this valley. So
that's crazy.
Yeah.
Absolutely wild. Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully things tone down over there and people can, that's where the Mars rover is. Two people are talking about it now. But it is too bad that things haven't settled down over there. It would be nice if that part of the world would settle down enough that it would be more conducive to tourism, because they could make a ton of money off of that place to begin with. And if we could get some archaeologists out there and doing some real work, that would be great. No, he's not claiming all of those were axe heads. Pay attention and listen. He said a lot of those were what they call flakes or chips or micro flakes, and they were mostly human artifacts. That's what we're saying here.
Yeah, we'll just say there's a lot of hand axes down there. That's all I'm saying, is there's some number that I couldn't count of hand axes.
Numerous hand axes, and like you said, the stuff, the byproduct from making them is in a lot of places as well. And that's evidence of human habitation. If you look at how archaeology is done, if they go to a site and they're not sure if humans were there or not, they start finding pieces of stone that were flaked off of an arrowhead or flaked off of a spear point or a hand axe. They don't need to find a hand axe, a fire pit, or anything. If they are certain that those were flaked off by human hands, they know that site had human habitation and they'll mark it as such.
Oh, yeah.
So,
absolutely.
Atlantis was in Greenland is one of the things. Some stones flake. What kind of stones are there? What kind of stone was that? Do you know?
I have no idea, to be honest.
All right. Well, yeah, that's I can't begrudge you for not going to test it. But those dead definitely look like numerous of them definitely look like they've been worked. Some things can be naturally shaped like that, but that number, that doesn't really make sense.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, absolutely. There were a lot of hand tools down there. And they appear to be quite old. I would say they most likely predate the theorized timeline for Atlantis. So I'm not sure that it's like evidence of Atlantis. But if we're looking at a city, some kind of early dense settlement of hominid ancestors, these artifacts don't tend to associate with Homo sapien. They're more often associated with Homo erectus. So we could be looking at something sort of like a Homo erectus city. And when I say city, I don't necessarily mean some kind of stratified social environment. I talk about it more in terms of just a dense population in one place. And you can get into semantics over the definition of city. And that's of no interest to me. I'm just saying it looks like a lot of hominids lived here and made tools here. And most likely that was a Homo erectus. But again, you know, that's also speculation. So.
Oh, that's really interesting. No, that's, it doesn't, yeah. I know it's crazy and I know some people might be watching and get upset about this, but it doesn't have to do with the lost civilization to be interesting. It can just be part of human history or even pre-human history. In this case, you know, if it was a bunch, I mean, the main theory is like from genetics and stuff, we pretty much know that humanity evolved in Africa. And so like us spreading out sites like that are kind of tantalizing. Imagine if there was some Neolithic school for teaching your kid how to make a hand axe or something like that. And this is a place there is,
that's what we're looking at.
Yeah. It's here in Washington. They found a bunch of Clovis points, a while back that were the largest ever found. And they had a unique style of fluting where it wasn't quite the same as the other ones in the country. And, one of the main hypotheses is that it was because they're all so big and because they're done a little bit different, they think it might have been a site of a tutorial for teaching kids how to, this is how you make a Clovis point, here's this big one, emulate it with, just like you teach a kid to write with big words and then they simmer it down. It was just a way for them to learn how to make these points. So it's an interesting idea to think about things like that. Like, and yeah, the term city is definitely loaded as far as that goes. They're going to want it to be a permanent settlement and, you know, structures and infrastructure. And, but, a place where a large number of hunter gatherers met once a year, even for a couple of weeks at a time, would still qualify in some ways as a, you know, would be more of what you were talking about for those out there who are going, it's not a city.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, I don't want to use the term city, but how else can we refer to some large population of hominids in one place doing something that seems to be somewhat organized? And maybe there were structures there. Maybe they were made out of wood. Maybe they got blasted with a flood. But what's curious to me is how all these artifacts are on the surface of the sand. That's what doesn't make any sense, because if these artifacts are somewhere in the range of hundreds of thousands of years old, as these Acheulean artifacts tend to be, you know, that would have predated the African Green period. And again, I know that Africa, the Saharan Desert, was green 7,000 or 8,000 years ago, and I don't know how far back that stretches. And then if it was ever a desert before then, which it might have been, my understanding is the Saharan Desert kind of flips back and forth between desert and lush savanna in relation to the wobble of the Earth's axis or something like that. But anyway, these tools had to have been on the ground for a long time. They must have accumulated a lot of sediment over the African Green period or the Saharan Green period. And then maybe when the Saharan desertified again, all that soil perhaps blew away in the winds, revealing these artifacts. But it's very strange to see such old artifacts just sitting there right on the surface as if they were made there yesterday, but actually they're supposedly hundreds of thousands of years old. So,
yeah, that is kind of a weird part of it, which it does make you wonder. I mean, I joked about it being an old archaeological site, but it does make you wonder if somebody wasn't digging and just setting these up, like taking interest in it for some reason, which it wouldn't have been any time recently, because my God, I don't know. I haven't been there, but I'm assuming that you probably weren't, you'd probably, even going there prepared, you probably weren't ready to stay there more than a couple of days tops out in that environment. It's not really a place to go digging for fun.
Yeah. You don't really stay out there for too long. You kind of bring all your food and water and supplies for a couple of days, and then you go out by truck, and you know, you hope to God that your truck doesn't break down, because that's the last anyone's going to see for your life. So it's not the place you want your truck to crap out on you.
Yeah, I would imagine not. I would imagine not. That's pretty nerve-wracking. But yeah, it's crazy to think that there's places like this that have, you know, there's questions to be answered. That really what it comes down to is it doesn't really matter what anybody thinks about it at the end of the day, is that if we just don't know. And here, if like one person in the chat said, maybe it was a scam that's the person set up. That looks like an awful lot of rocks for somebody to arrange in order to trick somebody. And if there was a steady stream of people like yourself going to the reset, it would make more sense. But like we were discussing, it's kind of hit and miss, I think, with the tourism, right? They're not exactly like people just streaming out there. So it doesn't make sense to go building a tourist site out in the middle of the desert that only a few people come to check out. But
The guy that showed it to me didn't try to sell me anything.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's all these different ideas about what it could possibly be. But really what we need to do is go look. And that's that, you know, we need to get people out there to go dig in the ground and look and see what we have. Sadly, the people and situations like this, and I'm always reminded of, because I'm old, I'm always reminded of the face on Mars, because when that was a big deal, they wanted to send, like, the next rover that was going back, they wanted to send to that face on Mars, and NASA was just like, fuck off, guys. And the whole the American public was just like, there's specials on TV about it, and I forget the dude's name, but one dude was like spearheading this like gung-ho charge to get them to, and they just, it feels like the same kind of thing where it's like if the wrong people latch on to this site, idea, whatever, anything associated with it is just going to be ignored by the academics that actually have the ability to do something here. And that sucks. Hey, Sam from Illegitimate Scholar. I'm going to be on his channel here later tonight, guys. I'm packing in a bunch of streams before I go hang out with Graham. So, yeah, I squeak in a nap and then go stream again in 7 hours. But Sam was here on my channel here a little while ago. He's another guy who helped a lot with the Flint Devil crap, digging into the claims that he made.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally aware of all that. I don't really want any part of it, to be honest.
Yeah, I completely understand. But shiplack wall behind him, archaic, is gorgeous. All right. That's from the Legitimate Scholar. Yep. And Sam says hi. If you know who Illegitimate Scholar is, I believe, right?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, yeah, he says that. All right. But yeah, I guess let's touch base on your book one more time before we call it good, because I definitely want people that tune in at any point of the stream to get that, because I said it a few times now, but I'll say it again. That thing is, it's a resource. Even if you don't agree with, I'll put it to you this way. If you were an archaeologist and you thought that every single word in that book, as far as cultures connecting each other, was crap, it still is a valuable book, because it's got numerous of these examples of these naval grabbing statues all over the world. And they're archived as to where they came from, the times that they came from. And it's the fact that it is connected with copper and agriculture is extremely interesting, extremely tantalizing. But even if that's the kind of thing that somebody's not interested in, it's still a great catalog of almost 200 of these navel grabbing statues. So it's a worthwhile investment.
Yeah. Oh, I want to mention one more thing that I haven't gotten to talk about yet.
Absolutely. Well, go for it.
Talked about the book. I'll give it one more plug. The book is The Mystery of the Naval Idols. It's on Amazon now. You can search for it. And, of course, it covers statues and figurines from around the ancient world with their hands around their navel, similar to the Moai of Easter Island, Urfa Man and the T-Pillars of Göbekli Tepe, the Palindo statue of Sulawesi, Indonesia. And then what I wanted to share before we go is just the fact that a lot of these naval statues also have these V-neck garments. So you can see this one on the top left is from Anatolia. Sometimes they're double V-neck, illustrated with two lines. Urfa Man, of course, is top right. Bottom left is a Vinča statue from 5000-ish BC in Kosovo. Bottom right is a figurine from the Indus Valley from before the Indus Valley civilization. So the pre-Indus period of the Indus Valley there. And so that's one interesting thread that I found on several of these naval idols was the V-neck or the double V-neck, as I like to call it. And then another intriguing thread of connection amongst these statues is the fact that they all have pegs at the, or a number of them have pegs at their base. So on the left, that's an Ozieri idol from Sardinia. And that was the culture that predated the Nuragic civilization. The next one's from China, next one's from Israel, and then the final one is Urfa Man. So a lot of these idols would have pegs to stick in the ground, which on the most basic level seems to indicate some kind of similar ritualistic function perhaps. So there's some interesting commonalities among these figurines and idols with pegs and V-neck garments as well. So,
yeah.
That real quick.
No, I'm glad you mentioned that. I was just speaking with Dr. Martin Sweatman yesterday. I'm going to edit the chat and post it after a few days. But one of the things in his latest paper on Göbekli Tepe, he's talking about the potential of it being a calendar. And V's are part of the is a symbol for a day, according to his interpretation. And he points out that some of these statues have these V-necks on them, and his with a double V-neck, and his hypothesis, just his kind of spitball, he's like, it's speculation, but it seems to me like maybe this is some sort of like a time god or something like that, that these represent days. So just, of course, that's we obviously don't know for sure, but it's interesting to think that's why it would have, if it was part of some sort of religious symbolism, that having that V other esoteric symbolism, it would make sense that it tended to travel around like the holding of the hands did.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And while we're on the topic of V-necks, I just want to bring up Pillar 43 of Göbekli Tepe. I know that gets a lot of attention.
Never heard of it.
Let me see if I can pull up a good image of it here. Okay. Give me one second here.
You're fine. Yeah, we had at least one person said they bought your book for the pictures. So, thanks, BRH. Big rolling home.
Share screen. Okay. So here we go.
Another one here. Just ordered the book. Look at that. Bam.
Awesome. Yay.
Thank you, boo.
I appreciate you. This has been my life's work for the last 3 years, is literally traveling all around the world to museums and ancient sites, trying to document the prevalence of these naval idols in the archaeological record. So I just wanted to get out there. I know people are curious about the hands of these statues, and I just want people to know how deep it really glows. It is really this global phenomenon. But again, we're looking at Pillar 43 of Göbekli Tepe here.
Oh, sorry.
And this vulture, what do we see him wearing but a V-neck garment?
Mm-hmm.
Like that, these naval idols.
That is, you see the V's right above that? They're...
And that's what Martin Sweatman was talking about.
Well, he's numerous of them on the site. Like in the paper, it's got all the days, your 364 days, and then the V on the vulture there being the 365th. So that is the completion of the year from his calendar is the V on that animal itself. So it is interesting. It's wild that he came up with the number. It's a pretty interesting paper, and it's kind of interesting as well because one of the things that's both it and his original interpretation of Pillar 43 are kind of hard to prove, but they're also kind of unlikely to have occurred on their own without the way that he puts it together and stuff. This is kind of unlikely that that would have happened by chance. Mm-hmm. When the two of them put together and they dovetail like they do, all of a sudden it looks pretty robust. It's, you've got two pretty unlikely scenarios that are dovetailing here and saying the same thing.
Interesting.
So yeah, anyway, that'll be live in a little bit, but that's interesting that you pointed that out. That is, we do see that V-neck quite a bit. And these kind of things, you just have to wonder where, how did some of these things become so popular? Some of these symbols just, I mean, that's the navel grabbing is so mundane, but you know, it's like this, it's not like a symbol of a man with his arm raised or anything like that. It's just mm-hmm. it's a guy holding his tummy. It doesn't really look like anything, but when you start seeing it over and over and over, if you walked into a room and everybody had their hands on their stomach, you'd feel mm-hmm. like you walked through the Twilight Zone, right? So,
yeah. Yeah, and you know, some people have raised the point that that's just the most convenient way to carve hands on a statue, and that's why they do it. It's the most, I guess, streamlined way that respects like some kind of oblong shape that most of these statues are like carved from. And I think to reject that, I would argue that I've also seen every other hand position you can imagine across ancient art. I mean, these hand positions get so weird, and literally every hand position you can imagine is out there amongst the world's museums of ancient art and Neolithic art, but this is the only position that repeats across all of them. So there are many, many, many different hand positions that you see. Noticeably absent is ancient Egypt. All the sarcophagi, the hands are always crossed like this, and there's no navel idols from anywhere in Egypt that I was able to find, except for Bes, which is this like a dwarf kind of god of, I believe, music, and he sort of like has a really interesting look. But Bes is the only statue or figure or deity in Egypt that tends to have his hands on his navel. But
no, that's a good observation. You know, my thinking is if you're going to put somebody's hands on their navel, as a statue, you're going to put their hands in that kind of position. If you're talking about, these are generally speaking supposed to be like figures of power, like the Moai at Easter Island were supposed to have been important people of that area. So you would want them standing, generally speaking, you would want the pose to, you know, symbolize that. So in my thinking, hands on your hips or arms crossed across your chest, these are the two that are just generally speaking, like universally amongst humans, symbols of, indifferent power, right? I'm above the conversation. If you stand back and cross your arms, it's kind of a symbol or you put your hands on your hips. So it seems weird to me that the hands on your hips, you would have to have the negative space for the arms. So to play devil's advocate, that would be a little harder to carve, but arms mm-hmm. crossed across your chest and stuff would be just as easy to do. You could actually tuck the fingers in and not have to carve the goddamn fingers. That'd be a whole lot easier, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Or just leave the hands and arms off completely.
That would work. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, awesome. Yeah. Is there anything else you want to say? We'll go ahead and I think we've covered
a lot of ground today. Yeah. I don't really have too much else to say at this time. I've got, I will say one more thing.
Yeah.
In my journeys around the world while I was writing this book, I did a lot of videography and got a lot of videos of ancient sites and places and a lot of interesting things that I think people have never seen before. But I've been waiting to release all of it until the book was available because I need to finance these expeditions somehow. But I'm going to have a lot of really interesting videos coming out on my channel over the next months and years of all the footage that I got while I was making this book of many things other than the naval idols that I think will be really interesting to people.
No, awesome. Yeah, definitely. Everybody should follow you down below. There's links to the Twitter and the YouTube. Make sure and go give Graham a follow here. And we will, and check out his book again. Really quickly, Lord Anubis, I have not checked out that thread yet. I'm talking to somebody locally about the merch thing, and I'm going to have them, I'm going to look at that page when I do that. Yes, there's his book. Show that one more time, please. Let's go ahead and put you on the screen by yourself.
Mystery of the Naval Idols.
And again, 195 or so different naval grasping statues cataloged, which is the only place that I am aware of that you will find that. I was not able to find any place else that has a book that just goes through them. And like I said, you take stone clamps or stone nubs. Try to find me a book that archives all the stone nubs or all the stone nubs somebody found. That just doesn't exist. And that shit gets really difficult to research because of it. So that book right there will save you tons of legwork and a lot of traveling that Graham did as well. So
it may be connected to the nubs as well, right? I mean, people like Graham Hancock are looking for a lost Ice Age civilization to try to explain the similarities that we seem to inexplicably observe amongst ancient cultures around the world. And, you know, it could be that a lot of these skills were being spread in tandem as like a package. And so maybe the nubs, I mean, there's so much debate over the purpose and function of the nubs, but maybe whatever it was or whatever purpose or function they had were spreading in tandem with these metalworking skills and agricultural skills and symbolisms. And, you know, more and more, it seems like these packages were kind of spreading and then mutating as cultures kind of evolved in situ over thousands of years or hundreds of years. And so, yeah, the nubs could be related to this, to the same phenomenon.
Yep. It very well could be. It could all be part of the same package, you know, like you said.
Yeah.
All right. Also, I really appreciate you coming on, Graham. I hope that a lot of people go and check out your book. Awesome. And I'll make sure, like I said, I'll make sure and let Graham Hancock know about your book. I can't say that he'll pimp it, but I would imagine that he would buy it, knowing him, once because the amount of research that it would save. So we'll see what he says about it. But
are you going to see him in person?
Yeah, I'm meeting him in a couple of days.
I can send you a copy, and you can just give it to him.
Oh, okay. Well, you'll want it to get here in a couple of days, so you'll
rush. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Cool. Awesome. Well, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much. This is great hanging.
Yeah, it was. All right, everybody. Thank you so much. Sorry, the Lifestyler stream starts on his channel at about 7 o'clock my time. All right. I got to call it a day so I can go take care of my son, and then I'll be back to go stream again. Thanks again, Graham. And I really appreciate the work you put into that book, man. Seriously.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate all the work that you do.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Have a good one.
Adios.